Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be hearing about some of the most macabre experiments I think I've ever talked about on the show to do with flies. So don't worry, it's not too upsetting, unless you love flies. But really interesting research looking at what happens when a fly is introduced to another fly corpse. Very unusual research, to say the least, but also the results of the research, very interesting. Stay with us for that. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also tweet us, we're @NewstalkScience. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and we're joined in the studio by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Ruth, our first story has to do with genetic engineering.
It does. It's genetic modification of a very close relative of the tobacco plant to get it to produce a particular type of sugar that is normally found in human breast milk. So these sugars, they're called human milk oligosaccharides. So they're complex sugars that we find in breast milk, are not something that we can replicate at the moment in infant formula. They're quite complex molecules, and though there's a few of them we've managed to make in bacteria, and they have been added to some formulas, but there's a whole family of these. You know, there's about 200 different types of these, and they're very, very interesting because they vary hugely based on a wide range of factors. So what the mother's been eating, you know, their weight, their geographical location, their race, you know, there's a whole load of things that shift the balance of all of these different sugars in breast milk. But we do know that some of these particularly are very important for the beneficial effects of breast milk, like boosting the immune system. And, you know, of course, you know, there's lots of different benefits that have been studied for children who've been fed breast milk, including things like, you know, potentially even increased cognitive abilities relatively early in life. So this study, the scientists sort of reprogrammed the plant's own sugar making apparatus, and they inserted the genes that, you know, make the enzymes that will create these multi-branched complex sugars. And they were actually able to produce 11 different types of these human milk oligosaccharides. And in that 11, there's at least one from each of the three major groups of these sugars. So what they're saying is this could be used to create these relatively cheaply and easily. And you could add these then to breast milk, or in fact to other foods potentially, if they do genuinely have health benefits.
From a chemical point of view, are these sugars that are made from not a tobacco plant, and obviously there's nothing to do with tobacco or any danger to do with these. It just happens to be a plant that's sort of related to the tobacco plant. These sugars, are they chemically exactly the same, or are they more complex when they're produced by humans, or more personal to the human in question?
I mean, I think the specific individual chemicals are the same. What's not going to be replicated here is the delicate balance in human breast milk, where you're going to get all of these different types of sugars, and all of the levels are going to be turned up and down depending on all of those different factors that I talked about. And there's even some evidence to say that, you know, breast milk will change as the infant's needs change.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously, you know, a human mother feeding her baby is a much more complex set of interactions than is ever going to be replicated in formula milk. But, you know, for mothers who are choosing to use formula or who need to use formula, this could potentially bring some of the benefits. So that can only be a good thing.
And it's possible then, once you've genetically engineered this tobacco plant to create these sugars, it's possible then to put them into a digestible format. That's the whole point.
It is. As I said, a few have already been made using normal microbial fermentation, using things like E. coli in big reactors, but actually growing them in plants would be more cost effective. And actually the separation process when you do it in a big bacterial reactor is very complicated because there's some toxic byproducts formed, whereas in the plants there actually aren't. So, you know, even though it's far from commercial yet, the researchers do think this one has much more potential to scale up and to create a wider range of these sugars that could go into formula milk.
Finishing on the obvious question I probably should have started with, why this particular plant?
I mean, the tobacco plant has a long history of being used as a sort of model organism in genetics. So we have Yeah, it's been used for a long time. And one of the first modified, commercial modified plants actually was the tobacco plant.
Right. And so there's just a lot of understanding of how, how it makes things. And then, like Drosophila or zebrafish.
Exactly. And clearly the sugar making enzymes or mechanism in this plant, you know, was similar enough in scale and size that they could insert the cassette of genes that were needed to make these human sugars.
Okay, very interesting. Our second story, Shane, has to do with trains. I thought an anorak like you loved this story.
Thank you, Jonathan. And always thank you for the votes of confidence in my personal interests. The train bit is cool in this story, but I think the physics bit is even better, right? So physicists are obsessed with knowing where we are, right? So we have things like global positioning satellite systems, the GPS, right? It uses two satellites in orbit to triangulate where we are at different points. We even have things in our phones called accelerometers that are able to accurately measure movement. That's how we know how many steps we're taking a day. GPS is great, but it's very limited. It can't work underground. It isn't entirely precise enough, say, for an autonomously driving car. And you could be in the shadow of a big building and it may not work that well. So we need other ways of knowing where we are. And so enter the London Underground and an imperial scientist called Joseph Cotter, who works at the Centre for Cold Matter at Imperial College, my old alma mater. And doing great work there, right? What they're able to do is to exploit a quantum effect. So quantum effects normally apply to tiny, atomic-sized objects, where you're able to exploit their wave-like nature, right?
Subatomic.
No, atomic.
Oh, atomic,
right?
Okay.
So like atomic level. But you can actually tap into them at the macroscopic, as in more than a couple of atoms, if you can create a state of matter called a Bose-Einstein condensate, right? Really, really cold. Actually had the good fortune to bump into the Nobel Prize winner who was given the prize for discovering these in Colorado last week, a guy called Carl Wineman, who's looking at the moment to understand, is the electron actually spherical? More on that perhaps on our program in future months. But back to the train. What they did here was they built what they call a quantum compass. So it exploits the wave-like nature of these Bose-Einstein condensates. It brings them onto the London Underground to test them in a real-world scenario and to figure out, can it accurately say where the train is or where the instrument is at any instant. It works in the lab, but sure, the lab is grand, right? But these things have to work in the real world. So this guy, Joseph Cotter, has been taking it on to the district line.
It's not a small instrument, either.
No, it's like the size of a trolley you'd see on an airplane for getting your drinks, right? So it's like that size. It actually reminded me of that. As somebody who travelled on the underground for years when I was studying in London, I was like, how in the name of God did they get that down the stairs? And also get it on the train without Londoners going bananas. But they did, doing science with their super cooled instruments. And it's working. And it's fantastic. And it's only the beginning, perhaps, of a whole new type of technology using this quantum compass idea, which exploits the wave-like nature of matter at that scale, as opposed to the particle-like nature of matter as we know it.
Right. I suppose I was going to say, we're hardly going to have this in our phones or handheld devices, are we? But then almost every piece of technology we've had once was the size of a house.
Yeah, so, the issue as I see it at the moment here is, how do you create something that's scalable when it requires super cooled materials? But, you know, it's the beginning of something.
Yeah. Our third story, Ruth, has to do with electrical stimulation.
It does. This is a study that was published in the Journal of Psychiatric Research from researchers in Iran and Germany. And they were studying something that they call love trauma syndrome, aka a broken heart. So their premise is that there is a syndrome called love trauma syndrome, which you get after your heart has been broken and you're sort of depressed and anxious. You may have mood swings, obsessive thoughts, and anxiety, insecurity, etc. So they recruited 36 volunteers who claimed to have love trauma syndrome, and they split them into three groups, and they they got them each to wear a device. And that device looks sort of like a hairnet that they put over their head. And what it does is it gives sort of transcranial direct current stimulation into their brain twice over 5 days.
That's going to help if you've had your heart broken, right? Just putting on the net.
Absolutely. In one group, they aimed it at one part of the prefrontal cortex. In the other part, it was aimed at a sort of more frontal part of the prefrontal cortex. And in the third, the headset was switched off. And what they found was that those who got these electrical currents felt better. And they found a month after the treatment stopped, they also felt better. So they concluded perhaps that these results require replication in a larger trial. I would argue they do, and that they probably need to think about designing their experiments better.
Oh, really? What's the problem with the experiment?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I was discussing this with a neuroscientist colleague, and I mean, he described it very well as this is sort of science theatre. So this looks like a proper experiment, but there's so many issues with it. I mean, this isn't even a properly described syndrome.
Yeah.
There's no sense.
There's
of
no
severity.
Parameters of.
There's no parameters. There's no double blinding here. I mean, when you're getting this type of transcranial direct current stimulation, you can feel it. So, I mean, this is a classic potential example of the placebo effect, where the people that were getting no little buzzing sounds and warmth on their head knew they were getting no treatment and hence didn't feel
better. Who signs up for this? Let me put electrical current through your brain.
When you have a broken heart, Shane, you'll do anything.
Well, the only thing, I mean, there's a bit of sort of, you know.
Have you ever been shattered over a relationship you had?
As loath as I am to discuss this on national radio, yes.
Yeah, me too.
But coming back to this, I mean, one thing that, you know, spot red flags here, you know, there's
we were having a moment here and you're like, oh, let's get back to the science. People care about
they do.
I was trying to rescue Shane.
Thank
from
you,
the
Ruth.
Well, I was about to share my story, but never mind.
Well, you can go on, Jonathan. We'll listen to you. We just don't want to tell you about our experience.
I see you were trying to make sure. I wasn't going to ask you. All right, fine. Go on. Tell me about the science.
Well, they're talking about the fact this headset can be bought now for about 400 quid sterling. So obviously part of this is the idea of selling something to people. It sounds great. 5 minutes a day. You know, we'll just target this particular bit of your brain and you will feel better. So, look, I think I think
buy anything off the internet that you're going to be attaching to your brain and then passing a current through that. I mean,
the current
Charles
is
Darwin.
Very low. It's about 400 times lower than you would use for something like electroconvulsive therapy. And, you know,
so still, though.
Yeah, well, still. I mean, and it's not. But also the evidence that this works is very, very sketchy so far.
It's an area that has enthralled me because there has been a bit of hype about it. There was some work looking at snipers and seeing whether or not they could improve their learning very quickly. There's been chats about how people could learn how to. No, they actually have. What are you looking at me like that
I'm
for?
I'm just imagining schools with all these caps on kids and say, you got it wrong. Stop.
Yeah. But
it's called behaviorism.
The idea is that they could help, the electrical connections that are created when you're learning, that they can speed it up. I don't know if there's anything conclusive, but there's been some claims, some fizzing out in the internet.
There have, but we've talked about really good studies on things like pain, where there's been objective measures around pain. And those are very hard to do. You need large, you know, study groups, you need good measures. And unfortunately, you know, while it would be lovely to think that you could cure a broken heart using something like this, I think at this point, I don't think we believe that.
Tissues and a good movie.
Yeah,
chocolate.
Some
chocolate.
Ice cream.
Absolutely, yeah. Ice cream, yes.
Our final story, Shane, is another train story, which is very unusual. And it's an interesting question. How long is too long for trains?
Yeah, well, according to my 3-year-old nephew, not long enough, right? But you know, when you're in the US and you see these enormously long trains going past, the longest is 3.5 miles, right?
Which is, what?
Yeah, incredible.
One train,
3.5 miles. I don't know how many carriages are on that. Ruth can quickly do the maths while I continue with the study
here. 8 kilometers.
Yeah. No, it's not that high. It's pretty long, right? So there's no limit in the US as to how long a train can be. And they do move freight very efficiently. But they're worried as to maybe it's too long. Ruth was telling me before we came on that due to cutbacks in the US, now some of these trains might only have one individual on them, right? Which is very risky if you think about what could go wrong. So enter my new favourite journal, the Journal of Risk Analysis, and a paper from Utah, which looked at basically, do longer trains have a higher risk of derailing, right? And derailing for a train is a really bad thing. So being good statisticians, they did amazing work in this paper, right? They had to calculate the risk, but they didn't have a baseline. There isn't an awful lot of information of how many trains are out there at any given instance and how long they all are. The only time you really record it is when something goes wrong. So they didn't have the baseline data available, so they had to use something called a quasi-induced exposure, right? I'd never heard of it before. But basically, it's a way of evaluating one type of accident using another type of accident as a baseline.
Right.
So what they did here was they took one where they called... they looked at one type of accident called the beat the train accident. So this is the classic from the movie when the train's coming and you're thinking, can I get ahead of this train before, in other words, can I cross the crossing before the train hits me?
A la Indiana Jones.
Exactly. Now, in Indiana Jones, it invariably works. For a lot of people, it doesn't. And I always think of this when I'm going through Sandy Mount. I wonder, do people really go under those barriers? And given the amount of dents in them, they do.
Oh, yeah.
So, they have a lot of information about those, right? And in those scenarios, the driver doesn't care how long the train is, right? So they're able to tell all the conditions about those accidents, including how long the trains are. And then they're able to look at just the number of derailments that happen in the US. There are something like 300 a year. It's a lot. So they found that if they compare different scenarios, say like a 250-car trains with a 100-car train, the 100-car trains at an 11% increased risk of derailment. And if you go to 350-car trains versus a 150-car train, it's an 18% risk for the longer train.
Okay.
And the trend goes up and up and up the longer the train gets. So right up to a train of a whopping 250 carriages has a 28% higher risk of derailing. So what the statisticians are doing here, that they probably should have been involved in that study on the broken heart, is they're saying don't read too much into the exact percentages, but look at the trends. And you need to consider that if you have a huge long train, that you really are increasing the risk of something going wrong, consequences for the driver, for people around them and all the stuff on the train.
What is too long though? I asked the question, how long is too long? Are you not going to give me an answer?
No, they don't give an actual answer to that. Isn't that brilliant?
Wasting my time.
Further research is required.
Why invite you in here? It's absolutely useless.
This study took 10 years.
Did it really?
Yeah, it did. I just thought this is somebody's PhD. They've gotten to the end and they're like, just publish it.
Might have been the same with the broken
heart.
You can let me know your thoughts on that. And if you've ever seen one of these enormous trains, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCT, Dr. Ruth Freeman, thanks very much. Now, for many obvious reasons, we humans do not like to be around dead bodies. We would expect to have an innate instinctive response of fear and revulsion if we were ever unfortunate to find ourselves in such a situation. And that's easy to understand, but what's not so clear is why merely seeing dead bodies could shorten an animal's lifespan. And yet that seems to be what our next guest has observed. Her name is Christy Gendron. She's Research Assistant Professor in Molecular and Integrative Physiology at the University of Michigan. This is a fascinating subject, Christy. So before we go into the work that you do with flies, can you tell me a little bit about our sensory inputs and how they have an effect on our bodies?
Yes, of course. So we, in our lab, have studied the effects of many different sensory inputs, whether that be the input of light, the smell of food, even the perception of the opposite sex, and have found that these cues that are given up, that our body receives, causes changes in our underlying biology, which results in changes in how the fly lives, so that how healthy they are, as well as how long they live.
Yeah, I actually just had one of my kids show me a video of, I think it was a kitten, and it had an Apple Watch measuring the heart rate of the kitten, and then they showed the kitten some food, and the heart rate jumped through the roof. So I suppose it's unsurprising in a way that our senses will have an effect on our body. They sometimes prime us to eat. They can prepare us for battle. They can better ready our bodies to run away if we need to, and so on. So that, I suppose, is well established and not surprising. And we see a range of physiological symptoms across different animals. Isn't that right?
Correct. Yes. This is true across taxa. Yes.
But the work you do at Flies, I think, goes just that little bit further in my mind. So let's start off talking about the interesting one, which is the dead flies. Tell me a little bit about your hypothesis for doing an experiment like this, what you did and what you found.
Yeah, so the background on that is actually we weren't intentionally studying death perception. The actual background for the work was that we were interested in understanding potentially if flies could recognize sick flies and how they would respond. Would they socially communicate this information to other flies? Because you can imagine that that would be a good thing to do to keep everyone healthy. So when doing these experiments, we found that nothing really happened to the live flies that weren't infected with anything, even though there were other sick flies that were infected with a bacteria, until they started dying. And at that point, we realized that it was the live flies were observing the dead flies, and that was what was causing changes. Because then we saw these stark changes in their physiology. They lost weight. And then we saw, you know, did a lifespan analysis and found that they lived shorter.
They lived shorter because they saw a dead body?
Yes. Many experiments took us down that route, but ultimately, that's what we discovered. Now, we did a lot of different control experiments. For instance, you might imagine that if you take a live, healthy fly and co-house it with fresh dead, that they would be exposed to a larger bacterial load, for instance,
yeah,
or pathogen load. And that's what's causing the fly to die. But if we do the experiment under sterile or infection-free conditions, those live flies still die.
Oh,
so
wow.
That suggests that that wasn't it, what was causing it.
So it's not some sort of contagious bacteria that's present. It's merely, at least it sounds like it's merely observing that there is a freshly dead fly in
yes.
your vial that makes you freak out and die sooner.
Yes, that's exactly true. And then we did a lot of different experiments, to support this hypothesis. Now, our intent wasn't to prove our hypothesis, but just try to gather data. And we found that of all the different sensory perceptive events, sight played a role, because if you take the flies, with their live flies with their dead, and put them in complete darkness, they live just as long and they don't show any weight loss as compared to flies that never had dead in their vial to begin with. That's what cued us in, that it was probably the sight was having a huge role.
Wow. So that rules out any chemicals or any hormones in the air or anything physical that's transferring between the two. If this doesn't happen when they're blind, then it's actually seeing these flies is causing a very serious effect on them.
Correct. And we've also pushed it even further and took these flies and the live flies and then put the dead underneath a plexiglass panel so they could see them but couldn't interact with them. And they still had access to their food source. And those flies still show the effects, I should say the physiological effects of seeing dead.
You created a sort of a transparent tomb inside the fly's house?
That's exactly what we did. That's a great explanation.
I've interviewed a lot of people on this show, but this is certainly charting into new territory. So, so that's really, really interesting. Can I ask, was it possible? I mean, with flies, is it possible to measure brain activity or motor function or like it? You know, what was going on inside the bodies of the flies when they witnessed this dead fly just lumped into their home?
Oh my gosh, that is the question that we have. And yes, it is possible. We're actually trying to do some 2-photon imaging to actually be able to see the brain in real time. We haven't gotten there yet. Again, this is in progress, but we do know that's the power of using flies. There's a lot of genetic tools available.
Yeah.
And so that's how we were able to discover that serotonin signaling, we believe in the brain, plays an essential role. We were able to identify specific neurons in the fly brain that played a role in how observing dead impact the lifespan of the flies. And we were able to implicate insulin signaling as having a role in this process as well.
Is this the first case of documented trauma in flies leading to reduced longevity?
Not trauma per se. Maybe if I might be bold to say psychological trauma, perhaps. I mean, we cannot imagine exactly what a fly is feeling. But yeah, that's kind of the road that we're trying to gently go down towards. I think that this type of research could potentially enlighten us about how, so we call it brain states. So how different neurons work together to cause an effect. And so, you know, what we define as being hungry is one type of brain state. What we define as being depressed is another type of brain state. Now, whether that's what a fly also interprets it as, I think is a moot point. However, I do think that by understanding these brain states, even in a fly, where we can observe the fly behavior in order to infer what the fly is thinking, could give us a lot of information that would help people who have different types of disorders, whether that be physical or even mental.
Before we get too carried away here, exactly what sort of an effect are we talking about in terms of longevity? I mean, how long does a fly live, and how long does a fly, when it's been presented with a dead friend, how long does that live?
Yeah. Yes. So a typical fly in our lab will live pretty long. In your house, maybe only 2 weeks, but in our lab, we really love our flies. And they probably live about a span of 80 to 90 days.
Wow.
When exposed to their fellow dead, that can be decreased down to 60 days on average. It's quite an effect. Yes.
Oh, no, that's really significant, isn't it? Oh, my God.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So obviously we have this very unusual effect. Do other things happen? I mean, do you see changes in behavior? Like, do they demonstrate? I mean, obviously, if their lifespan has been cut by up to 30%, something's going on inside. Do you see them behave? Are they less social? Do they move less? Do they eat less after being in the vial with a dead fly?
Yeah, those are all amazing questions. And we don't know over like the entire lifespan of the fly per se. We have measured them at certain time points. We don't see that they eat any differently. Movement, they might move a little bit slower. We do have some evidence that, so flies have this intrinsic ability, or I don't know if you want to call it desire or need, to walk against gravity. We call it negative geotaxis. And it's an assay that we use to measure the health of the fly. When flies are exposed to dead for some time, you see that they do worse in this type of assay. So we haven't seen any type of freezing behavior. Is that something that might be more familiar with people who work with mice, you know, in terms of being scared or anxious? But yeah, these are all very interesting questions and things that we have the tools to try and dig deeper into. Again, looking at these things in more real time rather than specific points in time, if you will.
What about the way in which the fly dies? I mean, does it matter if it's, you know, if they see the fly dying, or it just arrives as a corpse? Did you measure something like that, or whether or not it's, you know, it was a particularly gruesome death, or it died naturally in its sleep?
Yeah, no, it does absolutely matter. And I think maybe it's surprising to people to realize that flies can discern different types of death. So for instance, if you take a fly and you kill it using by freezing the flies, those bodies, even if they're freshly dead, they look a lot darker, and the flies can discern that, and they don't care. There's no effect on their health if they're kept with dead that were killed by freezing their friends.
Why is that?
We don't know. We think that they can just visually determine that that's not a threat. For instance, and again, a hypothesis, flies that also need to be freshly dead. So if you take flies that are much older, you know, they've been like kind of decomposing, those flies also do not elicit any effect in live flies. So the flies that were frozen to kill them, as well as the older, they look kind of similar. Their bodies are dead, or, I'm sorry, very dark. And again, no effect.
They're not fresh corpses, essentially. So you're obviously, a fresh corpse is much more terrifying because you, I mean, for a human, you'd be wondering what the hell happened, what is this doing here, as opposed to going to a graveyard or a funeral or something where that you know what's going on. Just a fresh dead corpse is naturally terrifying. And this is true for flies.
Exactly. And we think what's happening is that it's causing a stressful situation, essentially. And then it's the outcome of all the stress, which is impacting the physiology of the fly.
Hmm. What about the other work that you do, looking at sensory impacts? You did some really interesting work with food and flies.
Yeah. So one of the treatments that has been shown to increase the lifespan of organisms across, you know, all the way from a worm or a fly up to potentially humans. There are people who are doing this, although it's been shown in mice, is dietary restriction. And what that means is to restrict the amount of food that you eat. You get all the nutrients that you need, but you're not eating ad libitum. You're eating up to, say, 80, 85%. If the same is true with flies, when you put them into a diet, that they are being dietary restricted. Now, if you expose those flies, who are living much longer than their fly friends that can eat as much as they want on the higher diet, to the smell of yeast. So that is their protein source in nature, yeast. If they smell it, the flies on the DR-restricted food live significantly shorter. There's no effect on the lifespan of flies that are eating the higher caloric food when they experience the smell. So just smelling the food can cause them to live shorter.
What is that? Is that like they're being tormented by the smell of food when they're hungry?
We don't know too much about
We're talking about flies. It's crazy to kind of, I'm anthropomorphizing here, which is a huge injustice to the work, but I'm just trying to find the right language. Like, that's crazy. Why do we have any idea what their hypothesis on the mechanism of that?
We don't have any idea about the mechanism, believe it or not. However, one might, again, hypothesize that, you know, they're receiving a signal that they there's a richer food around. And so their body is producing maybe more enzymes in order to degrade it better, or just putting more energy into being able to utilize that source, but it never shows up. So that disconnect could be causing health consequences.
Hmm. I wanted to finish up on the experiment you did with light, because this is really, really interesting. It doesn't make an enormous amount of sense to me. You exposed flies to different types of light, blue light and red light, green light, and so on. And you found that certain types of light had an effect on how long the flies lived. Talk me through that.
Yes. So that experiment, if I might backtrack just a little bit, the reason we got interested in that one is because we discovered that if we kept flies in constant darkness, they lived significantly longer than flies that were kept under the traditional 12 hours lights on, 12 hours lights off conditions. Oh. So that cued us into, there's something about being in the dark for a long time that is promoting lifespan. Or alternatively, there's something about the light that's causing shortened lifespan. And so that's why we did the experiment where we separated light into the different wavelengths. We did blue, green, and red, as you mentioned. We found that all of them negatively impact lifespan. Blue light by far the worst, and then green, and then red was marginal. In subsequent experiments that we haven't published yet, so this is completely preliminary and I think is very interesting, is that if you take red light and you pulse it under certain conditions, it's not on all the time, those flies, actually, you can make them live longer. And that's something that we need to follow up than flies, that are kept in complete darkness. I don't know the mechanism. Again, preliminary data.
I have a very confused look on my face.
Oh, no.
I'm going to be thinking about this for quite some time. But I've really enjoyed this. We have to catch up with you again, Christy. Christy Gendron is Research Assistant Professor at University of Michigan. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
I mean, it's really interesting what's happening in that work, right? But At times it seems a little cruel, does it not? I mean, it is flies. I don't have an enormous emotional connection to flies. I don't know if you do. Spiders would be different. I wouldn't tolerate that piece on spiders. I don't know. Why do we have our favourite things? Why do spiders get a pass and flies we're willing to subject to like the worst possible things? Some of that stuff did seem particularly unpleasant. Love to know your thoughts. You can email us science@newstalk.com. That is what some of these people did. We're looking back at some of your comments from last week. We talked about carbon capture, and B Green said, don't believe their hype. Trees and plants do a thing called carbon compounding. Year one equals X, year two equals double and double and double. 50-year-old trees are monsters at putting away carbon. Actually, any living plant sequesters carbon. They just need to be present and living. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. But carbon capture as a process is absolutely something that we need to figure out, and we need to figure it out alongside all of the other things that we're doing. And that's not my opinion; it's the opinion of EU and experts everywhere. It's you know, we need to figure out the carbon capture to take stuff out, as well as improve what we're doing with trees and animals and so on. Another says, what sectors are currently responsible for all carbon capture in Ireland? Agriculture is the answer. How come we never mention that? Well, forestry obviously is a sector that's responsible for a lot of carbon capture. Don't the seas, microorganisms in the seas capture a lot of carbon, I believe? What are they? Plankton? Another, he says, how much oxygen do these things produce as a byproduct? I think they produce water and oxygen, obviously, in water. So they produce some. Seeing as you're comparing machines to trees. Well, look, as I say, it needs to be done alongside it. It's not like, if we just had trees everywhere and 50-year-old trees, absolutely. But trees take time to grow. And without the growing, we don't have an enormous amount of time. If we could all plant, 50-year-old trees now and have them going straight away, that's great. But unfortunately, they take time, hence the name. We were talking also about Gatekeeper, which is an app that you film someone walking, and it can detect even the tiniest changes in the speed and the movement that you have. If you may have onset of conditions like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, which I think is insane that something like that comes out in your gait and how you walk. Someone says, I have a small amount of cerebral palsy. How would gait analysis work for someone like me? I don't know. I think obviously for MS or something that can be degenerative, I think you would see that change over time for sure. And you might even be able to see the onset of it before other symptoms. Because cerebral palsy, if I'm not wrong, it's something that you're born with, right? And symptoms are very early on as a young child. I think, I don't know, unless you're looking at degeneration, I don't know if it would pick up anything. But maybe we'll ask our guest from last week. Another person says, what about tinnitus? How is that expressed? And is there a way to help suppress that? We didn't touch that, whether or not your tinnitus would show up in your gait. But I don't know. I'm not going to discount it. I don't know. Maybe. I have tinnitus, which I got from a very loud party that I was drunk at and foolishly DJed for many hours with really loud music in my ear. And I enormously regret that. So I am all over it. Whenever we get anything on tinnitus and how to suppress it, I will be first to the microphone because I hate waking up with ringing in my ears all the time. And if you have any... if you have any tips on that, on managing tinnitus, I'd love to hear them. But that's it from us on this week's programme. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Simon Keane, who was helping out this week, and on sound, Hugo Da Silva. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.